I'm guessing, based on the 11 CDs in front of me, that one of the more recorded flutists of our time lives 80 miles from here, from Moscow, Idaho, and teaching at the University of Idaho, is the flutist Leonard Garrison. His latest album is an album of Telemann's 12 Fantasias for solo flute. Let's hear one of them. Get old number one in A major. And then we'll find out a lot more about these really interesting pieces. This three-minute piece played by Leonard Garrison, two simple movements of vivace and an allegro. The first of 12 fantasias that Telemann wrote for the solo flute, played by flutist Leonard Garrison, who is sitting right here. Good morning and welcome, Leonard.
It's always a pleasure to be on your show, Vern. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a pleasure to hear that amazing playing, that an amazing piece just within those 3 minutes, because I had the extra honor of getting a little bit of play-by-play as it went along, as you described how even when in that short amount of time, Telemann put together so many great elements for the flute. But let's back up for just a minute about the pieces about Telemann. First, Telemann was such a prolific composer. In general, and this is a real generalization, was he writing on commission, writing for his friends, writing, what caused these pieces to be?
Well, he wrote these pieces sort of on spec because he was an entrepreneur, and he was one of the earliest composers to establish a publishing house. And there is a published edition in his own. He's set up the typeface and everything. It's kind of messy. It's hard to read. Mm-hmm. But
it was a typeface kind of thing.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And he got better as he went along. But this set of pieces is from, we can't trace it right down to the year, but sometime between 1728 and 1732.
So which was where within his career? I can't remember.
He was, for most of his career, in Hamburg. Uh-huh. He was director of music for all of the churches there.
Okay, and chronologically, where in his life would that have been? Where within his creative output?
That's kind of in the middle. Yeah. So his lifespan is approximately equal to that of Johann Sebastian Bach.
Okay. Yeah. And so, the 20s were a good time for all those folks.
Sure.
As it were, the roaring 20s for them. And so so you say he did it on spec. And did he have a lot of great players around him in Hamburg to be playing these pieces?
Yes. It was a major musical center at that time. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks of Bach and Telemann as being parallel. Bach these days is much more famous and much more respected, but at the time, Telemann was the big guy in mm-hmm. Germany. Yeah. And so his job was one of the most important musical posts in Germany. So he had riches at his disposal, great players, great singers, and so on.
Yeah. And so you've gone on this voyage of discovery of the 12 Fantasias for solo flute, and there's a lot of interesting challenges there. Let's deal first with the kind of musical challenges for the listener. When you have only one line, how did Telemann keep the music interesting?
Well, he was ingenious in this set. First of all, the set is in 12 different keys, and keys are associated with certain emotions, mm-hmm. certain affects, we call mm-hmm. them in Baroque music. So they're 12 totally different pieces in terms of their character. But also he brings in dances to each. Each fantasy ends with a dance. So that first one you heard mm-hmm. ends with a passe-pied. And people at that time would have recognized the dance and start dancing as they're listening. But the most ingenious thing he does is figure out how to write counterpoint for a solo mm-hmm. line. So that piece we just heard, the first movement, was a prelude and fugue. Mm-hmm. It had a short fugue theme that was set to counter lines, and the flute kind of jumps back and forth between the melody and the counterpoint.
We'll spend a moment, and we're at, well, actually, I should have watched to see. It feels like it's only about 15 seconds in that the fugue starts. So, and I should have checked that out. What we'll do right now, we'll hear the prelude. I'll stop, and then we'll announce that the fugue is starting, so people can really hear exactly how that fugue happens. So here is the opening prelude of the piece we just heard. So that's the preludes now out of the way. So now we're about to hear the fugue. And so we'll hear the fugue's only about a four, five, six note theme, isn't
right.
it? That's really
right.
obvious. But then the question is, how can one, several note theme repeat while something else keeps going on? Let's just go ahead and play and listen to how
sure.
Telemann solved that problem. Thank you. et cetera. But that that shows really beautifully and brilliantly how he did essentially a two-voice fugue, but it almost feels like by the time he brings in the third time through of that really characteristic theme, it almost feels like a three-part fugue, doesn't it, to you?
Yeah, I think he's playing on the listener's expectations that you know, we want to hear that third or fourth voice coming in, and he brings it in different registers of the flute. So it's really clever.
Yeah, and now speaking of registers of the flute, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the instrument it was written for, and then kind of the variants on the instrument that it was written for. You did this on a modern flute. Would a Baroque flutist who's really good at playing the instrument have it any harder than you did?
Actually, probably easier, because the keys that Telemann chooses for these 12 are keys that really work well on the Baroque flute. He was a brilliant orchestrator, and he knew the instruments intimately. And so this is A major. It's really easy to play on Baroque flute. It's not quite so easy on modern flute.
Oh, interesting. So I understand why it's more easier on Baroque flute. Why is it less easy on modern flute, in a way?
Well, I think, for instance, choosing what kind of tone you want to use, you know, you don't want to use it the same tone that you would use for some romantic French piece. Mm-hmm. And you want to be discreet with your use of vibrato. There's a lot of difference in if you explore the 50 different full sets of recordings of these pieces. There's a lot of difference in their choice of vibrato and tone.
And speaking of the 50 different versions of people who have recorded this, it's also been done by recorder players. So talk, A, in general, about the relationship of the two flutes of the era, and then how this would or wouldn't work on a recorder.
Yeah, these pieces were definitely written for the transverse flute because of the keys that are chosen. The flute at that time played better in sharp keys. Mm-hmm. If, you know, A major, even E major, D major, and the recorder played better in flat keys. But also the range, there's some of these fantasies in character are very dark. There's one in F sharp minor that I just love. It's there's so much depth to it. And, you know, the recorder is so chirpy. Mm-hmm. You don't get quite that same depth and darkness.
Now, since you mentioned the one in F sharp minor, will we, if we just play the first minute or two of the piece, will we hear that difference
within
that opening? Okay, let's do this. This is Fantasia, my guest, Leonard Garrison, and his new recording of the 12 Fantasias. This is Fantasia number 10 in, yes, that's forbidding sounding key of F sharp minor. And so let's hear how that works and about those sounds that he just described. So the opening of the Fantasia in F sharp minor, and even Leonard, within that opening, even as in the final couple bars, he started wandering into some strange harmonies and keys that he implied, didn't he?
Yes, he's a master of harmony, and you know, a lot of the writing is arpeggiated. He spells out chords, so that's...
Well, there's no other way to do it, is
right.
It?
Right. Well, it's a way of defining the harmony, mm-hmm. and again, he's a genius at that.
And so does he, well, I guess they're all, anytime he wants to imply a harmony, he has no choice but to arpeggiate it, spell out the chord in that. But that was really an interesting way. Do some of them wander quite a bit away from the home key in the course of the 3 or 4 minutes?
He gives you a lot of harmonic surprises. You know, you're coming to a cadence and then suddenly he pulls you away and you go in a different direction than you expect. So, it's a lot of entertainment if you follow your expectations and then you go someplace else.
Yeah. Now, this was your pandemic project, PP, your COVID project, because this recording was done in the year 2020. And as you mentioned, with one flutist in a room, you don't worry about the safety.
Right.
So I'm going to project and assume that, A, you as a veteran flutist and flute teacher have known these pieces all your life, but I'm also going to project that you are much more inside them now than you were 5 years ago. Is that safe to say?
Oh, definitely. I think that I've loved these pieces all my life, and I've started... just for fun, reading the first one, and I couldn't put it down until I got through the number 12 fantasy. Throughout my life, I've been kind of collecting the ornamentation that I've put in for each one. Mm-hmm. And a year ago, I decided I'm going to complete this and do ornaments for everything. So actually, I'm publishing an edition of these 12 fantasias, and the main contribution of the edition is my ornamentation is written out.
Mm-hmm. And then I assume that in the best of all possible usages for a rising, brilliant young student, they would then look at your version, they would see your ornaments, they would learn them and play them, and then that would inspire them to do their own, right?
Yes, exactly. That's what I say in the preface. These are not meant to be final, but as models for what you can do. And they're based on, real Baroque models. There are two main ones. Telemann himself published a set of method sonatas where he gives ornamentation of a basic line. And then the Baroque flutist Quantz wrote a book on the flute where he has a chapter of how to ornament.
Yeah, and so you're just taking that a little farther. And so there's that. And then, and in a way, we've almost answered this question just by suddenly playing that such different one in F sharp minor that we just heard. But you say that, you know, the conventional wisdom, and I even made a tasteless wisecrack about this, was, oh my gosh, you're going to go to a recital of all 12 of these and you're going to look at your watch and wonder if they're all over, because if you've heard one Baroque tune, you've heard them all, and, you know, all of the bad cliches about the repetitiveness of Baroque music. And yet you say that it's been really successful for an audience perception. So talk about why.
Well, one thing is the different affects of, you know, each of them, but also he's drawing upon all of the available Baroque forms. So if you look at each fantasia, they're all, you know, 5 minutes or less, but one is in the form of a traditional Baroque sonata with slow, fast movements. One is a French overture, which starts with a section of dotted rhythms, dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, and then goes on to a fugue. And that was from the court of Louis XIV at Versailles. There's even a chaconne in one of them. So he uses all these different forms within this set.
Nice. And we're going to play the final. We're going to play number 12, which is 5.5 minutes long. So it's one of the relatively slightly longer ones. You define it on the CD jacket as three movements, a grave, an allegro, and a presto. But go ahead and talk us through it and give us some guideposts and some signposts before we hear it.
Right. Actually, the grave is just a short introduction to the allegro, and G minor is a real tragic key. So you'll hear that. It's the first movement is kind of fiery, I would say. Mm-hmm. And then the second movement, the presto, is a bourré. And dances in the Baroque had different social contexts. So the a minuet is very upper class, but the bourré is down and dirty. So it's, you know, like peasants getting drunk and having a good time. So my playing of it is, I would say, rather rough. Mm-hmm. But in the middle of this, is just magical. He changes from G minor to G major, and he brings in some bird song. And you can hear the birds twittering away.
So all that's going to happen in the next 5.5 minutes. If you don't have a meeting or have to drive anywhere, you could even go get some refreshment that might go along with the attitude of the closing of this. So this is Fantasia number 12 in G minor, as was just illuminated by Leonard Garrison, my guest. Let's let him illuminate it on the flute.
Thank you.
Concluding with that rather bawdy dance was the Fantasia No. 12 in G minor, Leonard Garrison, from that recording of the 12 Fantasias for solo flute on the Centaur label. And I'm just going to jump right in here, Leonard, and say that based on those preconceptions, is one going to get tired of hearing it? No, because of the fabulous variety. The thing that often drives me crazy in Baroque music is the repeats. Come on already, we've heard that tune.
Yes.
And he does not beat any tune to death at all, does he? He just moves right on to something else.
Well, that's what some contemporary composers should learn the lesson, is, mm-hmm. is there's... a value in brevity.
yeah, and certainly just to go on and move into the next thing with all that lovely variety. Any breathing issues? There's kind of an idea that in some Bach pieces, Bach expected you to be superhuman and figure out your breath and solve the problem. Is this that way, or did he realize that the flutists have to breathe?
I think Telemann is much more realistic in terms mm-hmm. of writing for the flute than Bach was. Mm-hmm. Bach's phrases are gone forever, and here you can always find a good solution for breathing.
Yeah, which is a good thing on the planet.